Good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH, streaming on all those smart speakers like Amazon Echo and Google Home. Finally, we've got a big announcement, an announcement that is so huge, it's what's trending.
What's trending? A Jason Rant exclusive.
I've been talking, sort of hinting at a project I've been working on for the past several months. And for those of you who are at the Freedom Series, you know the big announcement, but it's something that I am particularly proud of. Something that I had hoped to do when I was a young child. Yes, I was a dweeb when I was younger. I thought we would give it like what we normally do. We have Duncan there in the background. Duncan, can I get a drum roll? There we go. Okay. The big announcement that I have been waiting to mention for months now, and that I can finally tell you is... Oh. Duncan, stop. Do the little thing at the end. Oh my God. What is this kid eating? Why is he so... Oh my God. You gave him a candy bar, didn't you? You just gave him
a candy bar.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Why did you do that?
He asked for it nicely.
Yeah, but I had this big announcement. No, but no, I wasn't. That's not fair. I wasn't ready for that. He does it at the end. I wrote a book.
You did?
Yeah, I have a book deal.
Oh, no way.
But I feel like Duncan just ruined
it. He kind of did. He kind of stole the spotlight, huh?
Get out of the studio, Duncan. Bad Duncan. Bad. Yeah, well, I feel like it's now not as exciting. No, I have a book coming out. I feel, every time I say this, I feel the need to point out that it's not like a self-published book. Like it's an actual book that was acquired by a major publisher, in this case, Center Street or Hachette Books. They took on this project for me. The name of the book is called What's Killing America? Inside the Radical Left's Tragic Destruction of Our Cities. It's available right now for pre-order. What I'm not going to do over the course of the next few months, because this book doesn't actually publish until September, I'm not going to do the whole begging you to purchase. I will say this. Pre-orders for books, regardless of the content, is incredibly important. And a book's pre-sale, the numbers, the data, whether you're buying it from Amazon or Walmart, whether you're going at Target or Barnes & Noble, all of that counts towards the first week of release. It is very, 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 very difficult for conservative authors and conservative books to get listed at the New York Times bestseller. They don't tell us exactly the algorithm that they use, but it's not just based on book sales. But when you sell enough books that it would be embarrassing to them and hurt their credibility if it's not listed, well, you get a little bit of an edge. So I hope that people will support this book. I take a dive into the big cities in this country, not just big cities. We do some mid-sized cities. We take some detours in small towns, and we talk about how policy has been leading to what we currently find ourselves in, which are just crises after crises, whether it's the crime crisis, homelessness and drug use, whether it's about immigration and how an open border is contributing to some pretty detrimental instances, crime, housing issues at our southern border, but also expanding. I get into education. I get into reparations. And I try my best, and the whole goal behind this book was to not just tell you what the policy is, because remember, I criticize on the show pretty often the sort of transactional way that stories are delivered. You're told that a crime happened, but they don't tell you the why. They don't connect the dots to the policies. And so what I do in the book, What's Killing America, is that I point to why it's happening, why a policy was created. What was the thinking from the left behind the policies? Because unless we understand the why, it's very difficult for us to explain why we should move away from it. I give examples of policies across all sorts of issues that actually work, that are being implemented as we speak or have previously been implemented, but for political reasons were disregarded. So the book is available in hardcover, I will say this. I'm due soon to do the audio recording. Oh, boy.
How long is that going to take?
Well, they said...
A couple hours? Maybe an afternoon?
30 hours.
30?
Is the estimate for how long it will take.
30 hours.
Now, the book itself isn't 30 hours. They estimate it'll be about 10 and a half hours. But even if I were to be perfect, right, and just read it without any error, without any need for editing, just the idea of talking for 10 and a half hours straight is, oh, my God, just end it now.
I already do 3-4 every day.
I'm just terrified of the prospect of getting into a studio, reading my own work in front of someone else is already going to be a little bit awkward. But then have to perform, you know, there's a little bit of theatrics involved when you're reading a book. Otherwise, it's just, and the name, of the, like, I don't want to do something like that.
Are you going to do character voices and stuff?
When I do quotes, I have so many questions. Like, when I have a quote in the book, do I say quote? Or do I just change my voice?
I say you just change your voice.
But am I allowed to do that with women? Am I allowed to do that with anyone who's a person of color, or is that cultural appropriation? I don't know the answer. And so I'm going to ask that question of them. And then there's also the thing of, because I go into so many different cities all across the country, I will quote lawmakers or policymakers with whom I'm unfamiliar up until I did the research. And they have really funky last names, and I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, and I'm curious, am I supposed to be the one who Googles it and tries to figure out how to say their name, or does someone else do it? I've got all these questions. That said, the biggest part of this is to purchase the hardcover that goes towards the bestseller lists, and that will help create this into a success. I ultimately hope it becomes, because one bestseller list, I'm out. I'm out.
You'll retire?
Well, from the radio. I'm leaving. I'm going to go to Tampa. I'm going to get a nice little condo, and I'm just going to write for the rest of my life and do Fox News hits in between. I'm kidding. I'll always do radio. Uh-huh. No, I will. Don't give me that look.
Okay, well, we got to see if the book is good first.
The book is fantastic.
Okay,
so
good.
I posted on our Facebook page, facebook.com/JasonRantsShow, all the links. And again, you can go to wherever it is you purchase your books normally and just search What's Killing America by Jason Rantz. It will pop up. I would really appreciate it if you could give it a purchase. And then once you read it, give it a nice little review. Even if you hated it, lie. Just lie. You know that I'm fragile.
Well, hate reads count the same, right? Towards the bestseller.
Yeah, I don't care. As long as you pay.
Purchase.
As long as you pay, I am happy, but I would like to get the positive review as well. This is the most, oddly enough, the most nerve-wracking experience that I think I will probably have, because I generally don't feel anxiety, and I don't necessarily feel anxiety here, but it's curiosity as to how it will do, because it could bomb, right? It could be a total bomb, and the publisher will be like, we paid you how much for this to bomb? Really? Oh, you're not getting any royalty checks, are you now? Or it could be massive. And that would also be uncomfortable, weirdly.
I think you could handle that part.
I don't know.
Something new, something different. You're putting yourself out there.
Yeah, I am. So everyone go buy What's Killing America, Inside the Radical Left's Tragic Destruction of Our Cities. I can't tell you how many people, when I said I was making the announcement today, online said a combination of, are you leaving? Are you taking Tucker's spot? Those were the two that were posted nonstop.
Are you taking Tucker's spot?
I'm not taking Tucker's
spot.
Dang
it.
Although I will be on that hour to make this announcement as well. So appreciate everyone's support over the years. Without it, I would not have been able to get this cool opportunity put in front of me. And it always feels good when they come to you and they're like, do you have a book in you? And then you say, no, but it will be a book because I put my mind to things and then I accomplish. And I started writing and it didn't stop. I wrote too much. They said I had to cut like 20,000 words and then I only cut like 8,000. And then they said, we're just going to publish. We'll edit it and we'll publish. So I'm excited. Again, What's Killing America? Push the button.
What's Trending? The drug crisis.
The Seattle City Council is voting on whether or not they're going to change the municipal code to allow the Seattle City Attorney Ann Davison to prosecute for drug possession, to prosecute for public drug use. This is something that we talked about yesterday in the context of a really, truly bad faith, poorly argued editorial in the Seattle Times, which effectively says we should not, quote unquote, criminalize addiction. We should allow the addicts to continue to use and just give more money to the programs and the strategies that are completely failing. Now, right now, due to municipal code, in the city of Seattle, these crimes go to the King County prosecutor. But they're now gross misdemeanors, according to state law starting July 1st. To get it to go into the Seattle City Attorney's Office, there needs to be a change. And so Davison, along with two council members, Alex Peterson, Sarah Nelson, they introduced this bill, this law, I guess, or municipal code change, because number one, it makes total sense. This is common sense. You have a misdemeanor, you allow the city attorney to handle it. But number two, and for me, at least the most important, she's actually going to enforce the law, not to throw people in jail, but to put people into treatment. That's really what this is about. Now, the pushback from the abolitionist crowds, the activists, the ones who will use the bumper sticker, you're criminalizing addiction. That's nothing more than a bumper sticker. It doesn't really mean anything. We're criminalizing criminal behavior. But the end goal, the way that they describe it, is disingenuous. This is about pushing people into treatment. People who otherwise are saying no and no and no, constantly committing crime to feed their habit. And for some people, you need to have the stick. It's a carrot and stick approach. Just a carrot does not work. They don't like carrots. They like fentanyl. And that is the drug that is convincing them to not get help. And these people ultimately die on our streets. They die. Those are preventable deaths. Can you prevent all of them? No. Addiction is going to occur regardless of policy. But can we get to a point where we mitigate some of the impacts of this crisis? And I would say yes. We're in the middle, again, of a surge of fentanyl overdoses, fatal overdoses. Almost all of it is driven by fentanyl. We are right now on pace to exceed last year's record high. Since 2018, when the King County prosecutor at the time, Dan Satterberg, actually talk about this in my book, What's Killing America, he decided to announce, I'm no longer going to prosecute for personal possession of drugs. And he did this because his sister was an addict. And for her, what worked was treatment, not going to jail, not getting in front of a judge. Since that decision, every year since, we've seen a rise of fatal overdoses. I think they're connected. Ever since we embraced a harm reduction policy or strategy in which we say we're just going to, quote unquote, reduce the harm associated with drug use, not focus on treatment, but focus on here's a crack pipe, here's a clean needle. We've seen an increase of fatal overdoses. I think they're connected. You'll hear over and over and over again that the war on drugs was a total failure. Was it a failure? What part was not a failure? Because I get the idea of over-incarcerating. I don't think that that's the right move. But you know what didn't happen during the war on drugs? We didn't see a disproportionate number of black and brown people dying of fatal overdoses. Shouldn't at least a little bit about the end goal here be around saving people's lives? Or have we just completely given up on that? I don't want to give up on that. I think it's incredibly important. Back during the quote-unquote war on drugs, which undoubtedly happened in the sense of over-incarceration, at the time, they weren't looking to push people into treatment. They were solely looking into pushing people into jail. That's the difference between now and then. Now everyone, conservative or liberal, they're saying the exact same thing. We don't want to put you in jail. We'll put you in jail if we have to, but we're going to give you chances to go into treatment. And you know what? You might go into treatment and you might relapse and you might commit another crime. so you can purchase your $1, $2, $3 fentanyl pill. But so long as you're actually making a good faith effort to get better, we're going to treat you with compassion. But if you're going to constantly say no to us, if you're going to constantly break the law, yeah, you get to go to jail. Congratulations. You get to detox in jail. Prefer not to do that. But if we do have to, we'll go ahead and do it. Sarah Nelson, who's the co-sponsor of this legislation, she spoke with Como TV.
I believe that it will mean that that drugs remain essentially decriminalized.
And she's 100% correct that if we do nothing, if we make no changes, it will still be decriminalized. Back when this so-called compromise bill was agreed to at the Senate and House level in Olympia, statewide, I said this is great news for everyone except for King County, specifically Seattle, for this very reason. I don't know how they're going to vote. They're currently in the middle of public comment. So all the crazies, the ones who are professional activists, they're speaking up. And they will join Councilmember Tammy Morales, Shama Sawant, Teresa Mosqueda, and Lisa Herbold in saying no to this. Tammy Morales put out a press release. She would never actually do an interview in which she has to answer questions. But she put out a press release saying this ordinance was a, quote, unprecedented attempt to ramp up failed war on drugs. The city does not have to implement what the state has passed. It's true, they don't. You can continue to see more and more dead people. Or you can try this out. And right now, in addition to the two sponsors of the legislation, Dan Strauss, a council member who's very far to the left, who is in large part responsible for what's been going on, for the policies at least, he came out yesterday in favor of the ordinance. Now, he's only taking that position for political purposes. He's up for re-election. I'll take the vote, regardless of the intent. I'll take the vote. So now you've got Deborah Juarez, who's a council member who's not running for re-election. And you have Andrew Lewis, again, far to the left, is running for re-election. I don't know how they're going to vote. And I haven't seen an update as to whether or not they've given even a hint. I'm hoping, but will not hold my breath, that they will make the right decision here. The one thing that I'm feeling a lot more comfortable with is we're hearing more and more voices stepping up and saying, enough is enough, we can't do this anymore. These are liberal voices stepping up and saying this. These aren't the 17 conservatives. It's not me and my secret little conservative club speaking up. These are folks who are progressive. They vote Democrat reliably. They live in Wedgwood. They live in South Seattle. They live in Northgate. They live in Queen Anne, and they are saying enough is enough. You've got Reverend Harriet Walden, who is an activist in the community, very much a liberal. She is saying what a lot more people are starting to feel comfortable speaking up about.
Well, I think the city council should vote to pass the ordinance. It's not the war on drugs. They didn't live it, okay? So they need to stop talking about it. It's time for the Seattle not to mess up this time.
100%. They've messed up multiple times in the past. So in a few hours, we're going to find out if this will be, for once, the right decision, putting us back on the right path, or if we're going to take an even harsher and harder turn to the left. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending in the classroom?
Real America's Voice picked up on a story that I reported exclusively last week. The story about the Olympia School District's very inappropriate sex education course that decided to introduce kids to pubic hair art. Yep. Puberty blockers. The idea that there are 14,000 different genders and now a pronoun apparently is tree. Not making it up. It's available at ktth.com. They picked up the story, and normally I'm all like, yeah, I like it when other outlets, even if it's Real America's Voice, I'm a little kooky, pick up my stories. I like it. Fox talked about it. Newsmax talked about it. This one, however, went a little bit too far. Because one of the hosts, Karen Turk, and I have no idea who this is. I'm sure she's a wonderful lady. But her position here, way, 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 way too far.
Jason Rantz is a radio guy, does a good job as a news
person. I do.
An elementary school, I think he's out in the West.
Seattle.
And an elementary school offered sex ed lessons to students without parental consent. We're going to zoom in on the right in a second. Promoted puberty blockers, gender identities, pronouns like Z and tree, not kidding. Who uses a pronoun tree? Pubic hair, art, what the heck is that?
What?
For again, elementary school.
What?
This is not high school. This is not college. Now, of course, there's an investigation. I won't even repeat some of the stuff. You can see it for yourselves. You know, of course, okay, deodorant. People need to learn about that as they're growing up. But there was all kinds of...
Not in school. I don't think they need to learn that in school.
Elementary school.
Can they learn that at home?
Well, deodorant.
I get the deodorant.
You could argue
I guess. I mean, deodorant.
What do you mean you guess? What's wrong with saying you need to have deodorant? That one I just don't understand. I get maybe there's just this hardline position that sex education should only occur in the household. And part of me understands that, especially in the context of what educators have been putting in front of kids lately. I totally understand. But the fact of the matter is, not all parents are capable of having those conversations. Not all kids come from loving households. And I do think that there is a role for age-appropriate sexual education in schools. I think it has to be done in concert with parents, with a general societal understanding of what is and is not appropriate. But to say it goes too far for deodorant, have you met some people? They need this lesson still. And you're telling me that they can't get taught about it when they're young, when they're in seventh grade or... a senior in high school? Really? We're doing that? You catch that?
Yeah.
Got it?
100%.
Okay. I'm just saying they make different deodorants now that aren't what they used to. I'm not telling you to do like Axe body spray, which should be part of the lesson plan.
I think
no
that
Axe
should
body
be
spray.
At that age group.
Yeah. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Thank you so much for tuning in on this Tuesday afternoon. Activists are calling for a boycott against a Muslim-owned business over the comments that the Muslim business owner made about the LGBT community. And these comments were based on his religious perspective. And to me, this is not really a story about his comments as much as it is about the reaction to them. Because I would argue that the progressive reaction in this case just, again, highlights the hypocrisy when it comes to their activism, when it comes to their treatment of different religions. They claim to be tolerant. They claim to look at intersectional politics. And yet we have, in this case, a man. His name is Wasim Fayed. He's the owner of Tanour Restaurant. It's an authentic Lebanese restaurant. He's got one location in Sammamish. He's got one in Seattle, which I've been to many times. But it also turns out that he is a Sammamish planning commissioner. So he's a public official. And as a public official at a meeting on June 1st, he decided to weigh in on some of the training that he recently had to sit through. And when I say training and I say a government agency or a corporation, you know the kind of training we're talking about, DE&I. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Except they added a B. They said, and belonging, which is odd because I feel like that's what inclusion means, but okay, fine.
Did they redefine that one?
I guess. Maybe belonging means the opposite. Maybe they should just say indoctrination because that's really what this is all about. And he is clearly upset with having to go through what seemed to be indoctrination, trying to get him to change his viewpoints. And he decided to speak. He made a decision to speak up, even though this really has nothing to do with the planning commission itself, at least from a public-facing perspective. And he was open and honest up front. He's all like, what I'm about to say, probably not going to gel with everyone. And yet he said it anyway.
It is my duty, in my belief, to speak or to promote goodness. And when I see certain things that are not appropriate and not right, to at least speak about it.
Oh, and speak he did. He definitely spoke for about 5.5 minutes, making comments that ignited a firestorm of criticism and not just calls for a boycott of his restaurants, but it led to his resignation. You see, he condemned the DEI training because it conflated folks who are LGBT with racial minorities. And for him, that is not an acceptable comparison.
But then to club certain people who choose a certain lifestyle and say they are among the minority, I don't believe that is the right thing. And I'm going to be very specific. The LGBT community, and specifically creating a Pride Month for them, these are some of the most wealthy, the most connected people.
Now, there's some truth to the wealth part. That has everything to do with the fact that traditionally gay people who are in couples do not have kids. Now, that's starting to change with adoptions and whatnot, but that's why there's a higher amount of money in the gay community. The beginning of this statement is obviously just flat out false. You don't choose to be gay. It is an absurd position that some people still believe. I don't care if that's what you believe. It doesn't bother me as someone who is actually gay. He went on to speak in ways that some might say was taken a little out of context, while some might also say deeply disturbing and quote-unquote problematic.
So these are not a minority people who are disenfranchised, and then we need to club them as part of the minority people. So in my opinion, these are people that are promoting diseases and infestation into the mind of our kids in schools. So we as a community, we should stand up for this, and that's my belief, and that's where I come from, that I don't believe this is the right way of life. God created us a male and a female, and to go and go against the creation of God and to spread diseases in the community is something that we should speak up against.
Now, at first, when he says spread diseases, I think he's just misspeaking. He means indoctrinating in the context in which he was speaking. At the end there, though, I don't know if I can say he wasn't talking about literally spreading diseases in a community. So folks heard about this. How it got spread so quickly, it's a planning commission. No one goes to those. No one watches those except for professional activists. Or maybe this was leaked by someone on the commission or staff member. Someone from the city might have leaked this, but it spread very quickly. And online, a whole bunch of folks were speaking out, condemning this. And I understand why anyone might condemn those comments. I get it. But you have people calling for a boycott. Now, an activist named Elizabeth posted on Facebook that she wanted them to, quote, please ban Tenor and Tenor products in stores immediately. Who she's telling that to, I don't know. That would be illegal. You had a group called Platopians for Peace. It's a community group. Silly name. My God. They're organizing an effort. They're going to show up tonight to a meeting. I guess we found the people who will show up to a planning commission meeting, and they're going to be protesting or speaking out against this guy. Then, of course, some people went on the Tenor's Facebook page and left bad reviews. One of them, I do kind of like this one. It's very lame, but we've eaten here several times and the food is seasoned with extra heavy homophobia. That's kind of clever.
It's very dramatic.
She said she'd never eat there again. This is going on and on and on. And to me, like I said, I don't view this as a story about his comments. I view this as a story about inconsistency. Not what I think are objectively offensive comments. Just inconsistency on the left. Because you hear over and over and over again from progressives that Christians are intolerant of the LGBT community. And yet they always gave a pass to Muslims. They always gave a pass to Islam. You have activists and lawmakers calling out the Christian right, the fascist Christian right. You hear that all the time. They're antagonistic towards LGBT rights. And yet, rarely, if ever, do you hear these exact same people condemning Muslims who hold the same exact positions. Neither all Muslims nor all Christians hold antagonistic views towards gay people. And yet, if there's one Christian who makes an outlandish comment, how is it framed? It's framed as somehow indicative of this prevailing viewpoint of the entire religion. Everyone who shares that faith must believe this. they're Christians. I don't think that that's fair. The same way I wouldn't think it's fair to do the same thing to this man for Islam. Now, some progressives will argue that the reason why they focus or condemn the so-called Christian right is because you have lawmakers who they say create policy through that lens. Okay, fair enough. I think that that is a reasonable concern from your perspective, and I'll debate that. But in this case, Fayyad wasn't legislating anything. He's not doing any work on the Planning Commission through the lens of trying to take away so-called rights. That's not what he's doing. That's not what he's doing at all. He gets to hold religious positions that you and I disagree with. You get to hold positions, religious or otherwise, that I get to disagree with. That's the country in which we live. But when progressives view a world through an intersectional lens, eventually they have to pick a side. Now, intersectionality, to be very 101 on explaining it, everyone has different identities. The left says that there's systemic racism, homophobia, transphobia, sexism, etc. Intersectionality is basically the intersection of those identities to see who is the most marginalized. That's how I view intersectional politics. It's a contest. Who is the most marginalized? And at some point, there's going to be two groups of marginalized people or communities going up against one another. And then progressives will have to pick a side. Who's the most marginalized? And depending on the issue and really the location and the specific incident that we're looking at, they don't always side with LGBT rights, do they? Because when it comes to Israel and Jews, all of a sudden, the radical left progressives, they side with Gazans, who are predominantly Muslim. They side with terrorist organizations like Hamas while accusing Israel of, quote unquote, pinkwashing. Have you ever heard of that term?
No.
Pinkwashing is the claim that Israel, which is one of, if not the most LGBT-friendly country in the world, that they only hold that position because they're trying to hide their human rights abuses against the Palestinian people. That is the claim. It's an anti-Semitic claim. But even if they truly believe that, the pinkwashing nonsense, have you noticed they never acknowledge that when it comes to LGBT issues, if they were openly gay on the Gaza Strip, they would be imprisoned and or murdered, killed? They never say that. Why is that? Because in that case, the marginalized community that they are choosing to side with is not the LGBT community. Because siding with them might be siding with Jews, and they can't side with Jews. And yet, in this case, suddenly, there is this uproar when one Muslim person holds a view against the LGBT community in Sammamish. A few years ago, would this have been a story? Comments like this a few years ago would have been completely ignored. Completely ignored. Because at the time, they were talking about how the Muslim community is the most marginalized and needs to be the most protected. But now they're not going to side with this individual Muslim. Instead, they're going to side with the LGBT community because what's happening right now? We're in the middle of a culture war. We're having these conversations about transgender issues. And they have decided to say, okay, transgender people are the most marginalized. On our checklist of intersectional identities, this is the most marginalized. And so they're going to side with the LGBT issues over the Muslim. Now, ultimately, I don't care where people fall on this issue. I just support consistency. I just wish progressives would too. Because if you're going to paint a picture of an entire religion when it's just with Christians, why aren't you doing it with Muslims and Islam? And if you finally recognize that it's wrong to do that with Muslims and Islam by painting the entire religion by this one guy's comments, why is it that you still paint all Christians the same? Why can't there be any level of consistency here? There just doesn't exist the consistency. And that's where I view this story. A lot of people sent me this video. They wanted me to talk about it. So I talked about it. I give the people what they want.
It's accurate.
Yeah. You know what they want?
That's a good segment.
You know what else they wanted?
Your book.
A book. What's Killing America?
Is there cool pictures in the book?
I drew all of them. Hand drew.
That's awesome.
Large crayon.
I might actually pay for it now.
1-800-465-8770 if you want to send a text. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rand Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. There are two competing interests happening right now as it relates to content that is currently occurring. On the one hand, you've got Chris Christie, who just announced his presidential bid. He's speaking to a group of hostages, a group of potential supporters in Manchester, New Hampshire. And Tucker Carlson just dropped his first episode of his show on Twitter. I'm going to go with... Okay, let's listen to Christie for a second.
But let me tell you why they're talking about
So that's Chris Christie,
small...
who's announcing he's running for president. Now let's get to the good stuff. Tucker Carlson just posted his first episode. It's called Tucker on Twitter, which is going to get some people into trouble when they say it too quickly, I guarantee you, because I've already almost screwed it up many times.
Get into trouble.
Yeah, Tucker already sounds like a bad word, and then you add another T word. It's just, it's too much. But I'm excited. He's got his set. It looks pretty cool. And his first episode has to do with Ukraine. And today's story about, or it happened early yesterday or late last night, the dam being destroyed in Ukraine. It's being reported. I heard a lot about it in on the Brian Suits show. It's obviously being put on Russia, which would make logical sense. Let's listen to Tucker.
Blowing up the dam may be bad for Ukraine, but it hurts Russia more. And for precisely that reason, the Ukrainian government has considered destroying it. In December, The Washington Post quoted a Ukrainian general saying his men had fired American-made rockets at the dam's floodgate as a test strike. So really, once the facts start coming in, it becomes much less of a mystery what might have happened to the dam. Any fair person would conclude that the Ukrainians probably blew it up, just as you would assume they blew up Nord Stream, the Russian natural gas pipeline, last fall. And in fact, the Ukrainians did do that, as we now know.
I'm sure this will lead immediately to folks saying that he is a Russian propagandist, blah, 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 blah. But what he just said, not his opinion part or the analysis, what he just provided there are some facts. Now, you might not like his conclusions based upon those facts. Okay, it's fair. And I think he would argue that's fair as well. You don't have to agree with him. But others won't even tell you what he just told you, because they fear that it might send a message that they don't intend to send, which is Russia's evil, Ukraine's the victim. And you can hold that view while also getting this additional context.
It's very easy to understand. It is vitally important for you to support Ukraine because it's necessary for Ukraine to be supported by you. Your support is mandatory until it's finished, whatever it is and whatever that means. So shut up and support Ukraine or else you're in trouble. Back when they still taught logic, statements like this were known as tautologies. Something is true because it is. The more you repeat it, the truer it becomes.
He ends his program, as it were, and it was, what, 11, 12 minutes?
Yeah, something like that.
It's basically one of his monologues.
Mm-hmm.
At least for the first edition of Tucker on Twitter, he ended it with a message for the mainstream media.
Secrecy is a powerful tool of control. Stop asking how we got so rich. Here's another story about racism. Go eat each other. That's the program. That's how most of us now live here in the United States. Manipulated by lies, silenced by taboos. It is unhealthy and it's dehumanizing, and we're tired of it. As of today, we've come to Twitter, which we hope will be the shortwave radio under the blankets. We're told there are no gatekeepers here. If that turns out to be false, we'll leave. But in the meantime, we are grateful to be here. We'll be back with much more very soon.
Now, what does that mean, very soon? Don't know. And it's possible that he hasn't figured out what is going to be a more official structure to this program. Will it be daily? Monday through Friday? Will it be once a week, twice? We don't know. Whatever it is, I'm excited for it. Not just because personally I'm a fan, not because personally I wouldn't have a book if it wasn't for Tucker, who's providing a little blurb for it, but because I think he provides a perspective that you just do not get in the media. There are aspects to his analysis that you don't get anywhere else. Agree or disagree with any of it, I think it still adds to the conversation, even if, and I've held this position for me, I don't care if you agree with me. I don't need you to agree with me on anything. You can disagree with absolutely everything that comes out of my mouth. But the fact of the matter is, when you keep certain perspectives from being heard, you stymie natural conversations about issues that are really important. Because what some of these conversations could lead to, hearing analysis by Tucker you disagree with, oh, he's a Russian propagandist. Listening to that might make you stronger in your own position. And I think that's a positive, or at least that's how we should view it. So I'm looking forward to seeing what else he has to offer. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message. 1-800-465-8770. Don't forget, I posted my big news about my book over on our Facebook page, facebook.com/JasonRantsShow.